tell you, right? I'm terrible. I know I'm terrible. I look in the mirror and I'm embarrassed. Maybe I should quit. I just can't, like, seem to do anything right.
Listen. I can't make you a great dancer. I don't even know if I can make you a good dancer. But if you keep trying and don't quit, I know I can make you a better dancer. And I'd like very much to do that. Stay.
Are you gonna keep yelling at me?
Welcome to The Letterboxd Show, a podcast about movies from Letterboxd, the social network for film lovers. Each episode, your host Slim, that's me, and Gemma, are joined by a Letterboxd friend for a chat about their four favorite films according to their Letterboxd profile. We have links in the episode notes to the movies, lists, and people we talk about, so you can follow along and add those movies to your watch lists. Today, our guest is a great entertainer, a great humanitarian, and our dear friend of 25 years, comedian, musician, and podcaster, Grace Spellman.
Wow, that was good. And a little nod to one of my movies. I feel right at home. I feel right at home already.
Excellent. Grace, you host the Ringer Music Show. Your Letterboxd handle is your name, Grace Spellman, one L.
Thank you.
And your four favorites are three cute little indie music films that nobody's ever heard of and a political satire that inspired Veep. They are West Side Story, All That Jazz, Whiplash, and In the Loop. And now, on with the show.
Grace, let's be honest. Let's be frank with each other right now. You're a bit of a legend in the music scene. It's safe to say that right now.
Yeah, that's kind of why I'm like, did they mean to get me on the show? Like, is this right?
This is a very musically themed show today. And for those, I think a lot of people probably know you, but how much of your Letterboxd favorites have been deeply inspired by your People Dancing to Steely Dan Twitter account?
That's a new thing. For those who don't know, I had a brief episode where I decided to take videos of people dancing and then painstakingly set them to songs from Steely Dan. So it appeared they were dancing to Steely Dan. And believe it or not, they have nothing in common other than my need to, you know, waste time by entertaining myself via music. But thank you for bringing that up.
Anytime I'm low at work, you know, it's a dark day, I load up that Twitter account, play the pinned one, where that dude walks into the room. Oh my God.
That's how I started it. And I will say, people are like, why don't you keep going? But A, it was ruining Steely Dan for me, which I wouldn't wish upon my worst enemies. And then also, like, you just rewatch them again and you guys are fine. So leave me alone.
I was listening to a recent episode of the Ringer Music Show, and I can honestly say that I didn't expect the do's and don'ts of party playlists that I heard from on that episode. There's a whole thing going on.
Yeah, I recently did an episode on, they gave me the keys to the episode because my co-host wasn't there. And I was nervous out of my mind and I was like, I'll just talk about like party etiquette, about like, what if you go to a party and the person who's hosting it is just playing the dullest playlist and you know what you can, and you know what to play to get the party amped up. You know, when does it become too rude to be like, can I grab your iPod for a second? So I had a guest over and, you know, we talked about, you know, etiquette and arbitrary rules. So thank you for listening to that episode.
Oh, so great. I would like to volunteer myself if you ever want to do an episode about music, like wedding reception music etiquette. Little known fact, my parents ran a catering business for a long time. My Saturday job was clearing plates in time for the speeches at many, many, many wedding receptions, and it gave me the opportunity to listen to many a wedding DJ and observe the tracks that do and don't bang on a dance floor.
Okay, can I tell you something? In a few days, I'm going to like basically the first wedding I've ever been to, so I'm going to keep that on my mind. You know, I'll be vigilant and make sure everyone's following the rules and, you know, no one's doing any faux pas.
So I was going to say, did you say the first wedding you've
ever
been to?
So embarrassing.
Is that a real story?
No, it's the first like outside wedding. First of all, like I didn't go to college, so like I didn't get a lot of college invites through that, which is fine. But then I lived in New York City for a while and everyone has their wedding at like movie theaters or like a brewery or, you know, or like a warehouse. And so this is my first like in the woods in Portland sort of like dance floor wedding. I'm so fucking excited. So,
this is going to be amazing. I want a full report. I also, for the listeners who are like, when are they going to talk about movies? I do want to add that movies have a lot to do with what bangs on a wedding reception dance floor. I can tell you that for the 3 years after the release of the Kevin Costner Robin Hood, that goddamn song, Everything I Do It For You, was the first dance song for pretty much every couple who ever got married for the next three
years. That's from a Robin Hood movie?
Look into my eyes, you will see what you mean to me.
What?
Kevin Costner has been involved in some films with banging soundtracks, man. Yeah. I mean,
does it play during the credits or something?
Right. Yeah.
It might shock you, but I think that song still plays to this day at wedding receptions.
It doesn't shock me.
I don't think the wedding reception music has changed a whole lot in the last 40 years.
And here's the thing I'll say. Wedding music will go on until we die. And that's how I felt about Uptown Funk. Uptown Funk will be played at weddings when our grandchildren are dead. There's something about wedding music that will just outlive all of us forever.
We need to get into some movies right now. We need to get into some movies. All That Jazz is in your favorites right now. 1979, 4.2 average on Letterboxd. It has 1,200 fans. So 1,200 other people have that in their four favorites on Letterboxd. Roy Scheider, Bob Fosse, Joe Gideon. The top of the heap. I saw this for the very first time. I snatched up a Blu-ray from Criterion. So this week, I think Gemma also had to track down a DVD to watch this movie.
Oh, it was quite the epic journey. I had to go out into real life, into public. there is nothing downloadable. There's nothing streaming. The library didn't have it. Our last remaining video store didn't have it. But then I remembered the wonderful Real Groovy Records, who have secondhand DVDs, and they had one box set with New York, New York, Hello Dolly, and All That Jazz.
It is so hard to find. It is so, and which is, because I want to show it to every single person that I hold dear to me, but it's just so hard to get your hands on. So honestly, props to you.
Yeah, it seems crazy given Fosse Verdon, right? Anyway, I'm just going to share some of Jack's facts. So every week we get Jack at Letterboxd to pull some facts about the four movies. All That Jazz won 4 Oscars for editing, costumes, art direction, and original score, and frankly should have won Best Picture. It's Bob Fosse's highest rated and most popular film on Letterboxd, even ahead of his Best Director winning Cabaret. And it's in our top 250 of all time at number 191. And it won the Palme d'Or.
Wow.
Of all things. Wow. It tied with Kurosawa's Kagemusha. So that's pretty amazing. And it's in a whole bunch of great Letterboxd lists, including interesting death film theory list. And apparently it's David Fincher's all-time number one movie.
You know what? I'm not going to come in here and pretend that I have cool, unique taste or something that's like not popular. You know what? People love it. I love it. Like, you know, I am not ashamed of that. So I hear those stats and I'm like, yeah, that's damn right. We all love this movie.
Well, do you remember the first time you saw this movie and where it was? Do you have any memories of that time?
So I have two very specific memories of this movie. The first one, I kind of wish I could take back, but it kind of ties into my next one. I mean, the first time I watched it, I was depressed in my bed, laptop, lights off. And so many people, when I show movies, list, like, you know, like I said, I don't know why you guys had me on this podcast, because like, I'll watch movies on my laptop and some people will like DM me and be like, why aren't you watching this on your giant screen TV? And I'm like, well, I don't own that. If you want to buy me one, then sure. So I was like depressed in the dark, feeling very creatively stifled. Like I wasn't going anywhere in my bed. And it just, I mean, and it hit me like a ton of bricks, so much so that I think I didn't watch a few movies after it. But the next time I saw it, like the very next time I saw it, I lived in LA for 6 months in 2019. and my friend Gabe Gundacker, who's also kind of big on Letterboxd.
Oh yeah, we've had Gabe on the pod before. Yeah. We love him.
Oh, you have? Oh. And one of his favorites is All That Jazz, and he said it was playing at the American Cinematheque, which I'm still not like entrenched in LA enough to know if I'm right about this, but it was like a small theater in Los Feliz that kind of had like a Egyptian-y stone wall kind of feeling or whatever. And I never dreamed that I would see it in theaters. And I think this was the first movie I ever saw that was like old, like that had already come out years ago, but was playing in theaters. Cause I just wasn't really a moviegoer for a really long time. And so I was sitting there with Gabe and his then girlfriend, and I'd only seen it on my laptop. And I'm so sensitive to sound, like, you know, sound is huge for me, the quality of sound. And so I'm sitting there watching it. And it's moving me, but you know, the third act, which is that hospital hallucination scene, I am just sobbing, quietly sobbing the entire hour. Because it's literally him, like Scheider, sitting in a director's chair, directing his whole hallucination. And so you're like, okay, Fosse is sitting in his own chair, directing a guy who's supposed to be him. And he's probably in a chair too, directing the other guy who's in a chair. And it just became so personal. And I remember we were leaving the theater and Gabe and his like then girlfriend were walking out and going down the sidewalk, and they're walking like regularly paced. And I'm like slowly going behind them because I'm still sobbing. I'm still crying. And so I'm just like looking down and they're like, Grace, are you? Oh, Grace. And so I wish I could count that as my first experience, but it's not very cool to be like, I was in my bed depressed, but those are two.
It's 100% fine to own, you know, a mental health laptop bed watch. I'm here for it. We are like, honestly, the Letterboxd show has no judgment where and how you watch movies.
I know you guys don't, but you know, there are some people, you know.
I don't even want those people as listeners. Get them out of here if you're judging right now. Shut off the podcast app. My backstory with this is some of my friends had logged this and I was like, what is this movie? I'd never seen it. Roy Scheider as a choreographer, successful director in the musical theater. In my head, I was like, okay, I need to see this movie. What is going on here? That dance sequence, that like erotica dance sequence rehearsal scene. I mean, are you kidding me right now with that scene?
I mean, he was a famous Fosse was known for being a choreographer, but specifically like small, very personal, intimate sort of movements. Not, you know, like, you know, flashy, like jumping up and down, but like, you know, the placement of a hand on someone's back. And so it's got this really like, I mean, it's, and you saw it, and for anyone who hasn't seen it, it is sexual. I mean, it is sexual. It's like the horniest dance sequence I've ever seen, including Dirty Dancing.
Yeah, including Dirty Dancing. It's incredible. I was moved to watch the special features on the DVD that I watched the movie on for the first time, which was so, I'm so stoked about that. But Sandahl Bergman, who's the lead dancer in that erotica dance sequence, who gets her top off at the end, and it is, you know, and it's like full abandonment. She talks about being called up in LA by Bob Fosse 3 days before shooting that sequence to say, I've just fired the dancer that I've rehearsed in. I need you. You're the only person who can do this. And she's like, I'm about to go on holiday. And what did you do? Well, of course I got on a plane and went to Bob. Of course I would. Wow. And that his only direction for that final part of that dance sequence was abandonment. And you go, yes, yep, that's the word. That is the word. Oh my God, she's incredible. And it is amazing. So gratifying to hear her because, you know, obviously as a viewer, we're watching these extraordinary, sweaty bodies. Can we talk about the sweat? Sweaty bodies. Alone. Oh
wet.
My God. So much real, true, actual sweat. This is not, you know, a mister being applied by costume department. But it's so gratifying to watch something that's so sensual and so all about the body and hear the dancer say, it is all about the body. That dance is all about the body, and Bob loved bodies and the camera loved bodies. And what she appreciated about it was you can see the full, from the tip of her fingers to the tip of her toes, you can see the full body in the shot, which we just don't get enough anymore.
No, it's usually like in musicals, which I don't hate, but I'm thinking of musicals like Carousel, where they're in flashy things and they're jumping off the roof and doing backflips and stuff. But this is so much more, you know, it's the body.
How about the boots that Roy was wearing in that movie?
I mean, he looks so hot throughout that whole movie. Like
I wrote down in my review that like Roy in this era felt like Willem Dafoe before Willem Dafoe. His physique in this just felt very Willem-ish, you know, very like kind of... Grace's nod is cracking me up, but it's true, though, right?
I mean, I've heard some things about Willem Dafoe. I don't know if you talked about it on the show, but he did that really like sex movie.
Was it the Antichrist one? Or what was...
No, it was Antichrist, right? Where they were like, his can I say dick?
You can say dick.
He might have had a few movies where that appeared. I can't remember if it was just Antichrist, but there was something else, too.
It was like bothersome how big it was. And I feel like Roy has like big dick energy in this movie. Yeah. So your Willem comparison is very apt.
I mean, if you're going to say dick, can I just call out one of my favorite lines in the movie, which I love because Bob Fosse puts this in the mouth of Roy Scheider playing Bob Fosse, essentially. So it's Bob owning how much of an asshole he is. And it's when one of his many lovers says, I just wish you weren't so generous with your cock. And he goes, that's good. I can use that sometime.
And that's who he is. He's not a good guy. And something that like, when we were talking about, something I was thinking about before I came on, and something I really like that is kind of specific to that, I don't know, that I appreciate in the grand scheme of other theater creators, is when we were talking about this like overwhelmingly erotic scene, it's being done in front of these like suits, these musical theater guys who are expecting good, clean family fun to get butts and seats in the theaters, which is like kind of the way that Broadway can be sometimes when it's really about the money. And that scene, that dance sequence we were talking about, starts off like pretty tame and then slowly gets into this like outrageous, the complete opposite of what these producers wanted. And it's just, I mean, the guy's a dick. He's a dick to his wife. He's a dick to his ex-wife. He's a dick to his girlfriend. Mm-hmm. He's a dick to so many people. But the my favorite dickishness that I love is this way he was like, fuck you guys. Like, I'm not doing, you know, I'm not going to play by your rules, because he was already successful. And it reminded me, and this might be for like my real big musical theater nerds who want to listen to this, and you'll know what I'm talking about. But, and this is also like a kind of autobiographical work, is Stephen Sondheim, who is like, if you read his books, he was kind of like, this musical sucks and this other musical I don't like, and that guy's dumb. Yeah. But the closest thing he ever had to an autobiographical work was this musical, Merrily We Roll Along, which was basically about him and a writing partner trying to make musicals. And in one part, they go visit a producer who's played by Jason Alexander, and they want to get their show on Broadway. And they perform for him, and Jason Alexander is like immediately put off. It doesn't sound conventional enough for him. And he's like, oh, that's not a tune you can hum. That's not a tune you go bump, 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 da-dum. And so then on their feet, they try to like change it to make it like a little more conventional, but it doesn't appease Jason Alexander. And so he sings, he goes, just write a plain old mellow. And then he goes, dee, 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 which is a direct nod to South Pacific, a musical that Stephen Sondheim hated. And so it's this like, I don't know. As like a theater fan, you love watching these like geniuses be like, I'm the fucking king, you know? And like, fuck you guys, and fuck everyone who thinks like, you know what conventional theater should be. And so I think one of my favorite parts that isn't talked about enough is just like, how, like, you know, how much he was like, you know, he was a dick, but he was a dick to these people who wanted things by the book and wanted butts and seats and wanted tickets sold. So, and that's like the most endearing part to me.
We need to move on to a film that is seemingly the anomaly in your top four in terms of not being a musical, but I would argue that there is in fact quite a lot of choreography in Armando Iannucci's 2009 political satire, In the Loop.
This is a 3.8 average on Letterboxd, 161 fans. So 160 other people have this in their top four on Letterboxd. And I'll, again, this is my moment to be brave on the show. I had never even heard of this movie before last week. So listen, people out there, I'm with you. If anyone is like me. So how did you discover this movie yourself? And what was your first viewing of this movie experience?
So Like, you know, I probably got into it. I wish I could be like, oh, I liked his radio shows first and like blah, blah, blah. But that's not true. I watched Veep first and it blew me away. And I am an improviser myself and have a strong interest in politics and how dumb everybody is. And so I watched his show, The Thick of It, which I fell in love with. And then later listened to his Alan Partridge stuff and his earlier satirical works like On the Hour, which then became like a sort of absurd farcical TV show called The Day Today. And so, I mean, guys, listen, it was a very depressing year for me, the year I watched all these movies. So I did the same shit. I watched it alone. And I loved it. I love it. And it is, it's choreography, but it's just, I mean, it was a movie and I am not a big rewatcher of movies. But the fact that the dialogue, and this is very much how Veep dialogue is and how much his show, The Thick of It, which is pretty much the movie In the Loop is inspired by The Thick of It. There is one character in it, Peter Capaldi, who is the only one guy in that TV show plays the same character in the movie, the Scotsman who's swearing so much.
So he's for anyone who might need a reminder, it's Malcolm Fuckity Fuck Tucker. I mean, he is one of the greatest characters ever invented for British television, ever in the history of British television and character inventions.
I mean, yes.
He is. He's the government director of communications, right? And in the thick of it, in the series, he's in both government and in opposition, you know, over the course of the series. And he, my God, his mouth is so...
Okay, go ahead and print unforeseeable. Listen, see when I tell your wife about you and Angela Heaney at the Blackpool conference, what would be best, an email, a phone call, or what? Hey, I could write it on a cake with those little silver balls. Your hack husband betrayed you on October the 4th, and congratulations on the new baby. Yeah, maybe it's better to spike it, yeah. Okay, fuckity bye.
Here's the thing. It's music, man, you know? And it's just, and this is another thing, like I was saying, rewatching. It is constant dialogue being fired at you, so much so that like I had to watch it like again the next day because of course you don't remember. It's not like, you know, well thought out, like elegantly placed dialogue. It's people fighting and people doing really funny jokes. And so the rehearsal process, it is a lot of improv. So it's hard to compare it to music. But I don't know, it feels like music to me. That's not my favorite part. It's just a bonus that it feels like that.
What's your favorite part?
I think the reason why this movie means a lot to me is because I do like political satire and I do come from an improv background and it's so fun to see smart people do jokes like this. But something I discovered, and I think this is a personal thing. So when I lived in New York City for a while and when I first lived there, I actually lived in Massachusetts and worked in New York City and would commute back and forth every day on Grants through Grand Central Station, which is New York's most famous train station. It's a little bit smaller than Penn Station, but it's more famous. And there is a ton. I mean, it looks nice. I mean, don't even get me started on what they did to Penn Station.
Oh my God.
It breaks my heart. It's so crowded. It's just people just smashing into each other. And a huge part of the people, at least around, I mean, especially during rush hour at Grand Central, are these Wall Street nice suit guys going on the train back to their nice homes in Connecticut. But the nature of the train station is, fuck, the train is going to leave. And these trains leave exactly on time. And I would spend a lot of time in the train station because I get there an hour early due to anxiety. I'm afraid I'm going to miss my train. But something I would discover, and something I realized is probably one of the funniest things now, is people in nice suits just running, being stressed, or like falling down or looking stupid. And so it was these guys in great suits and they'd be like, and they look ugly and they don't know where they're going and they trip and they fall and they lose all of their power immediately. And I remember being like, holy shit, this is the funniest thing I've ever seen. And it kind of, you know, and then it made sense to me why I love shows like Veep and In the Loop and The Thick of It is because here are these like guys with a scary amount of power and they're so dumb. They are so dumb. And it just was like, okay, this is it. Like, this is who I am. This is the stuff that I love.
My favorite, here's a confession. In another life, I was a governmental press secretary.
Wow.
Too much of this film feels true. It is true that you have very, very clever people doing really dumb shit. And that something that you can have been working on for 3 years could be suddenly undermined in one meeting by one guy who just has slightly more power or a vested interest that you're not aware of. You know, you can totally get sideswiped at any minute. It's a scary, scary place. And then when you get to the UN, because there's also a UN element in this, and that's where it really goes off the rails and in the loop. I remember doing some filming at the UN and I got told off for eating my sushi in the wrong part of the building. And I just went,
what?
Oh my God. I thought this was like, whoa, the United Nations, but it's just like a bigger New Zealand parliament, which in itself is just a bigger high school, which in itself is just a bigger elementary school. Like all of this shit, it's just school ground politics.
And I feel like that's the thing with Armando too. And like, this is what I would hear people say, which kind of bothered me. But like what you were saying about how you had worked in government and being like, this is so real. I mean, this is what people had said when Veep was coming out and something would happen in the Trump administration. And they would be like, Veep predicted it, which I think is stupid. I think what it is, Armando just is good at tapping into what drives selfish, you know, greedy, vindictive people who are always chasing their next career high. I don't think he was like, one day we're going to get an orange guy in the White House and it's going to be like this or whatever. I think what it is and the reason why, you know, you felt like that and the reason why we're all like, oh my God, this is how it is because, you know, it's a funny, it's like farcical, but all, you know, these are the people that are in charge and stuff like that. So there's definitely like an element of like worrying realism to it, you know?
Just as bad as the Veep predicted it is the Simpsons predicted it. I grew up on the Simpsons. I can't stand it. Enough with this. Lord. Please.
Do they really think, here's my thing. If gun to their head, do they really think, you know, the writers of the Simpsons in the 90s are thinking about that? Or do you think they're just trying to make the Simpsons family as funny as they possibly can?
It makes me sick, Grace. It makes me literally sick when those articles come out.
If you have to step off camera and go throw up, I will understand.
Thank you, Grace.
Maybe just pour a glass of wine. It'll all be okay.
Yes.
I just love that In the Loop also shows the many farcical layers of politicking in DC from the pretend committee to the real committee that's got a different name. And then all the house parties, like the diplomatic parties that happen in all the houses, which leads up to one particularly beautiful scene that I know you loved, Slim.
Is this when they're in the bedroom?
Oh yes. My God, when they're sitting on that bed and he's
genius.
Using the kid the keyboard.
Gene, I think it is another just example of like sound completely making the scene. Just
100%.
I mean, they're trying to calculate the number of troops that would be required. They're in some little girl's bed at this party of a rich person trying to get away and, you know, talk about this very serious issue. And so he's like, looks around at the toys, picks up a calculator that's about like iPad size and is trying to do some math about troops. But every button he presses is like 1, 2, 3.
Good. Your military hardware is impressive, General.
Yeah, well, not anymore, it isn't. So you add these together.
Yeah. Very good.
So this is the number of combat troops available for an invasion according to these figures.
But because he's such a good actor, he is so committed and he was a great casting choice because he's just doing math the best way that he can as an actor. And then you have these nonsense kid sounds and it's just, I mean, it's one of the most brilliant things sometimes. And this is kind of like with that whole, but they're good at like giving people props. Like they're good at giving people like what is the silliest, funniest thing that this person could hold that isn't too crazy? And that was just, you know, a total example of it. I'm glad you guys like that scene also.
It's a beautiful thing.
Speaking of props.
Yes.
Drumsticks. We need to move into Whiplash.
I want you to know that in a strange twist for the sixth episode of this series of the podcast, this is the one film of a guest's that I failed to rewatch because I told myself I would probably never watch it again. And so let's dive into Whiplash, one of your four favorites.
This is a 4.3 average in Letterboxd.
Too high.
This has 22,000 fans.
Too many.
On Letterboxd.
Oh, I love
we
this.
We need to mute
so
Gemma's
excited.
Mic during this segment.
No,
this is
no.
getting too spicy.
It can't just be me, you know, puffing myself up.
So So this is a famous movie under the direction of a ruthless instructor. A talented young drummer begins to pursue perfection at any cost. Miles Teller, J.K. Simmons. This is a movie that I personally had not seen until this week. This was like in the upper echelon of like, you know, La La Land, Whiplash, Five Bangers. Like, you didn't see this movie, you're an idiot. I finally did watch this movie, but you're a creator, you're a musician. What was your experience seeing Whiplash for the first time?
Good Lord. First of all, let me say, I hated La La Land. Maybe you can ask me about that later.
Okay.
But I am not a... La La Land made... It felt like I ate too much candy and I felt like I was going to throw up. But
okay, we're friends again. We're friends again. It's all good.
Oh, God. Couldn't stand it. I'd never watch it again. But the first time I watched it was not alone in my bed. It had already come out by then. And it was with my roommate who was like, I feel like you'd like this movie. And I mean, this was before I would just sort of like, well, if a movie comes out, I'll watch it when I watch it. And as opposed to now where I've like definitely taken an interest more and you know, growing my own opinions and you know, caring more for film. But back then I was like, okay, sure. And definitely one of the more memorable movie experiences because like, I shit you not. And this is like, it sounds like it's maybe a joke, but the movie ended and I realized like my ass had been clenched for like an hour and a half, my whole body. I was literally, it was almost like I didn't realize it until the movie was over that I was like, and then like every muscle in my body sort of was released. And I think, I mean, if I want to like get a little autobiographical here, I think it was because the storytelling and the way that they capture, you know, tension and you feel like you're walking on eggshells and there's like all this uneasiness and unpredictability given J.K. Simmons' character. But I think the reason it like hit me especially and other people too, I'm not saying like you have to be a musician to fully understand it because that's not true because the storytelling is so good. You don't need to know about like the dynamics of a rehearsal room. You get it right away. You get
it. It's a sports movie, right?
That's a good point.
Yeah, it's a movie about obsession, basically. Obsessive need to improve no matter what it is. Yeah.
Yeah.
So no, you don't need to understand about music and you do learn quite a lot about drumming throughout.
Yes, you do.
Gemma putting a positive spin on her comments from earlier. She's trying to even the playing field.
Listen, I don't know anything about basketball and I watched Space Jam and I learned a little bit that day. Same with all the other sports movies. With the Aaron Sorkin one, he forces baseball rules down your throat with that one, you know, so.
I was the same. When I watched this week, I realized this is another brave moment for me. I realized I hadn't looked at my phone in like an hour and a half when I was watching
That's
this movie.
Right.
And then I was like, okay, something's cooking here. Mm-hmm. And you're right. The last 20 minutes of this movie are maybe one of the top five last scenes of a movie I've ever seen, I think.
Correct. Yes.
Should Fletcher be in prison? I ask you. This instructor, J.K. Simmons' character, I want to knock him out throughout the entirety of this movie.
Of course you do. But like, there are so many guys like him that exist. In terms of intensity, I don't think, you know, I don't think all of them are throwing cymbals at kids' heads, but that sort of like psychological abuse is like, to give you an example, we had, and this is like another reason why this related to me to bring myself into it. So I used to sing competitively in choirs and stuff. And I'm like very familiar with like the stakes that go into it, but there are things that happen in this movie where in another movie you would be like, okay, whatever. But for example, losing a binder of sheet music in this movie means something completely differently than in another sort of setting. And I had this conductor in one of my groups where, she would do this thing where she'd put extra sheet music on the piano in the rehearsal rooms. And sometimes we would memorize our pieces and sometimes we wouldn't. But either way, if you forgot your music or you hadn't memorized it, it means you would have to go up to the piano in front of everyone to get an extra copy. And it was the scariest thing in the entire world. And it was not okay to go up and get your sheet music. And another one I had, if you did that, she made you sing I'm a Little Teapot in front of the whole class. the whole class.
She should be in prison with J.K. Simmons.
Exactly. They should be in prison together. But it is that, like, it's that thing, and it invites you into this world where if I had been like, hey, so, and this had happened, like, you know, one of my choral groups would compete at Carnegie Hall. And if I had said, hey, I'm competing at Carnegie Hall to a person on the street, they'd be like, cool, good for you. But yeah. When you're in that world, it is, you're sweating and you're nervous and every single second and part of rehearsal, you know, it has 100 times more weight. So, mm-hmm. you know, that touched me immediately.
Hey, Grace, how do you get to Carnegie Hall?
You practice, practice, practice.
Just checking.
I say that all the time. And it holds up. How do you get to Carnegie Hall? You have to practice.
I want to say I don't hate the film. I just don't need to have my ass clenched through that experience again. Mm. The love for this movie on Letterboxd is insane. I think when I look through the reviews, it's either because people have great dreams of being great themselves and are responding to seeing what it takes, or it's just purely J.K. Simmons as a character, you know, on screen. And we love a good baddie, right?
Exactly. I was wondering looking at the reviews, what it was that would drive it. I had guessed that like the thing most mentioned would be the ending, because that's the thing that, you know, everyone talks about. Say JK's arms look really good in that movie, and so that's
always ripped. I don't know what his regime is, but I need to figure it out. Him and Roy Scheider probably do the same thing.
Yeah, black t-shirts. Wow. Okay, maybe there's something there for me that I have to talk to my therapist about. But the thing you were saying about the driven artist, like, I don't know. I'm like, why would you? I mean, here's the thing. The thing about the girlfriend, you're right. I hate that too, because he's a dick to her. He's a dick. I don't know why anyone. I mean, I get it. We all want greatness, but I do not. I mean, like, to relate to that guy who's essentially
run,
like, if
Nicole,
you're not doing...
Run. Yeah.
Right. Exactly. So I hope nobody relates to that guy because he sucks.
Before we move on to West Side Story, I just want to point out some of the hilarious lists that Whiplash makes an appearance in on Letterboxd. White people jazz. Anxiety. Secretly an A24 film. Good movie dads. Boys crying, a single tear. Homoerotic, ?
Okay.
Piss baby. And sociopathic artists.
Okay.
Which all that jazz also appears on. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Homoerotic, I believe that. That's that one I believe. What was one of them? Piss baby?
Piss baby. Okay, I'm just going to get a little more info about this.
Maybe I'm... Like, does it
we need to click
so?
Through on this. Maybe incognito mode, click through to get some more info.
The full title of the Piss Baby list by Kennedy. This is genius. Movies in which a hetero white man with a god complex is rude to literally everyone for his own personal gain and sense of achievement. This list could also be titled The Piss Baby.
So is Piss Baby J.K. Simmons or is it Miles Teller?
Ooh, good question. I'm thinking Miles...
Yeah, I mean, J.K. Simmons, there's a scene where he's nice to a little girl, but I guess he kind of has to be, or else we'd be like, this guy needs to be in jail right away.
Speaking of crying, West Side Story, 1961, 3.8 average, 926 fans, Broadway musical, 1957, talks about the West Side, Upper West Side of Manhattan, Jets versus the Sharks. Everyone's familiar with this and probably familiar with the music. They might not even remember it's from this movie. Tell us about West Side Story and Grace Spellman.
Okay, so 3.8, I'm going to credit to two things. I understand. Okay, here's the thing. For this movie, I guess it's my favorite movie, but for me, it is a vehicle to listen to what I believe is the greatest music of all time. It's also got a bonkers runtime. I remember a guy I was dating in 2018. He was like, he was trying to like play the moves and he was doing a good job. He was like, I want to watch West Side Story with you. I want to watch West Side Story. I want you to explain all the things in West Side Story for me, which is hits all my buttons. I get excited about things. And when a guy is like, I want you to talk about them, I'm like, oh yeah. So I sit down and he's like, almost 3 hours? And I was like,
No, I'm not kidding.
you.
I'm not getting laid for 3 hours.
He was like, sex isn't worth this, I guess. Well, he didn't say that, but that was the underlying message. And I was like, fuck you, Tom. And so then I had to sit there being like, okay, let's watch this musical number. And then fast forward and being like, well, they're going here, and then you have to watch this. And it sucked, and it was awful. It was awful.
Hey, that can go in our bad movie dates podcast series that we're gonna develop.
I would love to talk about that. But for me, I mean, okay, it's music for me. The Desert Island album question about what three pieces would you bring to an island. I love music so much that I can answer, but I only know one, and it's West Side Story. And I do love it for, you know, the set. I love the movie for the set and for its interiors and the gorgeous costumes. But like I said, it's a vehicle for listening to the music. It should be noted that I listened, it did start as a Broadway show. So, but when I listened to it, I listened to the movie version, which I believe to be better. And for my 15th birthday, I only asked for one thing, and I asked for the DVD. But I think the thing that is my favorite, because I do love storytelling through music and through dance, is the prologue. So I will differentiate that for those who don't know. A prologue is different from an overture. Sometimes people get them confused. An overture in musical theater, it's played when the curtain is closed, and it's when you hear the musical themes or snippets of the song that you'll later hear throughout the show. But the prologue is the first 10 minutes of the movie, and there's basically no dialogue. But here's the thing about it. It is the part of the movie where you separate the boys from the men in terms of audience because, and this happens so often, you sit down with people and within the first 30 seconds, the gang members start snapping. And this is when you lose people. And I can't count the amount of times that people have been like, what? They're snapping? And they're a gang and they're snapping. And not to be like, you know, like elitist or whatever, but I don't want to get mean on the show, but it makes me really mad.
I want to say the thing about musicals, right, is you have to be really on board with the idea of people singing their thoughts and dancing their feelings. And I want to know what is wrong with people who are not on board with that.
I feel like these are people, though, who can do it with Sound of Music, and they could do it with La La Land or something like that. But it's this like in the city, you know, basketball court, summer, hot heat, tension thing that just, I don't know, breaks their brain.
I was going to say, so I watched this for the first time this year for my podcast. And
are you talking about your podcast again, Slim?
Sorry, I didn't say it. I'm not going to plug myself. But
70mm pod.
We did West Side Story. Our community voted for this movie for us to watch for the first time.
And this is
in
70, right?
Yeah.
Panavision 70. It's in 70.
And also, I was lucky enough to watch this in 4K. Grace, I'm not sure if you've seen it in 4K.
Yes.
This movie effing slaps in 4K. It's ridiculous. So the dancing to display emotions is probably where people get lost. Like dudes that don't fight, but they dance to express emotion.
They dance ballet.
That's probably a huge disconnect for the audience.
And especially like, and it's not like, you know, In the Heights, which is like, it's a little different, but these guys are gang members and they're not doing like, you know, like gang dance moves. They are doing ballet. Jerome Robbins has them doing ballet. And it's the way that in the music and the dancing in that prologue is character introduction. And it is storytelling, but it is like, you know, like you were saying, the dancing in 4K, especially. I mean,
it's nutty.
It's incredible. And it's a whole 21 minutes before we get a song, before we get singing. Yeah. It's like, this is like up to almost 20 minutes of snapping and dance feelings.
Listen, if this were a music podcast, this would be a 3 hour long episode. And I am not joking. I would print out the full orchestral sheet music and I would just read it on the train. I mean, it's amazing, but even lyrically, and you know, and this is lyrically, it does touch on things like being an immigrant and being coming to America and dealing with poverty and dealing with racism. But the theater version is so much more racist than the original. But I mean, that's a conversation that we can maybe have when we talk about the original. But the songs are, I mean, they are immaculate. And it is love songs, but it is also like brilliant songs like Officer Krupke, where these jets who talk about, you know, living in, you know, in middle class or lower middle class, and they are, you know, being shuffled around from foster home to court judge to social worker to therapist.
Understand, it's just our bringing up key that gets us out of hand. Our mothers all are junkies, our fathers all are drunks. Golly Moses, naturally we're punks.
Gee, Officer Krupke, we're very upset. We never had the love that every child ought to get.
And they're just, it's so tight. And not only is it tight lyrically, but the way that Leonard Bernstein plays the music and the way that he uses instrumentation, more Latin American music for scenes with the Sharks. And you know, you get your American jazz when you have the Jets. And it just, you could close your eyes and watch this movie, you know?
I mean, we all know the story of Romeo and Juliet, and it's been told right. in hundreds of different ways and will be again. But for West Side Story specifically, the thing about Romeo and Juliet is that the two families are essentially the same class, but they're just at war, right? And so that's what kind of leads to the conflict. Whereas with West Side Story, you're adding in socioeconomic status, immigrant status, racism, gender politics, class politics, and it just, it stacks the odds so much more.
And police, and the police as well.
And the police, yeah.
Who also played a role. And I will say that, like, something, I mean, the like, you know, both of the gangs hate the police, which is like, okay, hell yeah. Like, you do not root for the police. But, you know, at the end of the day, when the police are in the scenes, they've got the backs of the Jets more than they have of the Sharks, mm-hmm. which makes it like, you know, Romeo and Juliet, God, it's been forever since I've read that, but it's definitely the police are this like third element because, you know, they're trying to have these fights under the bridge, but they can't tell anybody about it, you know? So they have to fight this war as quietly as they can.
When I watched it, some of my friends were logging out Letterboxd ahead of time and I hadn't seen it. So there was a few reviews calling out the, you know, the problematic nature of the characters, the Puerto Rican characters that were wearing brown face in the movie.
Obviously, the Puerto Rican characters played by Greek Americans.
Natalie Wood.
It's insane, oh
right? Like, looking back on it and watching it, you know, different time, et cetera, but still doesn't hold up that well. But Spielberg is making a new version of this. What are your vibes on his updated version?
I mean, he's a great director, so that's good. I'm basing it off the trailer here.
Yeah.
My first thought, and this is my nerdy thought, was like, are they going to do it in the same key as the original the original movie? Like,
I'm trying to think about
Ansel's like vocal range, and I'm like, well, they can't do it too high. They can't change the key. And so because the music is such, you know, it lives inside my brain rent free, to use a term that everyone uses. But, you know, I think in 2021 the casting will be way more appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
But also, how are they going to stray in terms of the story, I'm wondering, because throughout the movie, the Jets, who are the white gang, aren't the bad guys. You kind of root for them, but they are incredibly racist. So story-wise, I don't know how they're going to cover that, because it is really important to highlight that feud. But in terms of like visuals, from the trailer I've seen, I mean, in the original, the first thing they set up is this like aerial shots of the Upper West Side, and they paint this picture of a New York that's gritty but beautiful. And in the trailer, we kind of get a few glimpses of that as well. And there are some shots of Maria up on the balcony, who's Rachel Ziegler, who I'm friends with on Twitter. Shout out, Rachel, if you can hear this. You're so much cooler than I am, despite being so much younger. Please think I'm cool. but like some shots where she's wearing almost the same dress, and she's looking down on Tony, and it's almost like the same shots. I have a feeling, I don't know, but I also don't want to be one of those people who's like, you got to stick to the original, you know, because I hate those people. And when other movies do that, I'm like, be creative, let directors do their own thing. But for this, I'm like, oh, that looks just like the shot from the original movie. Nice.
Yes.
Right. Yeah.
Which I don't like in myself.
Yeah. I just want to say it's pretty exciting to see that Ezra Menez is playing the role of Anybody's, because we all know that Anybody's was a cute little baby non-binary gangster in the original, but just not, you know, not obviously. And in 2021, we get a fully realized cute little baby non-binary anybodies in the cast, and it's really exciting. It's great.
Yeah, I do that role. I don't remember. They don't use pronouns in that movie regarding them, right?
Well, right near the end when he says, you did good, and they reply, thanks, daddy-o. They say, you did good, buddy boy, or something like that.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
all
that's
right.
It's the only time when anybody's is referred to as potentially the gender they identify with. Mm. But other than that, they don't use pronouns, no.
That'll be great, yeah.
It's pretty exciting.
The shot in the trailer with the shadows, that fancy shot.
Yes.
That looked pretty baller. Oof. In that trailer.
Oh, God, I'm going to cry. You guys, I'm going to need an ambulance waiting outside the theater when I see this movie. I don't care if they're like, no going into theaters and Delta has like zombie apocalypse everyone. I'm going to be like crawling on my elbows to the theater to see this movie. So very excited. And I'm glad I got to talk about it.
Okay, I got three important questions. Question number one, are you a shark or a jet?
Well, I'm white, so I'm a jet. that's obvious.
Question number two, have you ever wanted to dance fight to settle an argument?
Yes, because I hate fighting and I hate conflict. And I feel like if I had some dance moves, it would go a lot easier for me. And maybe they would just laugh and be like, you're so bad at dancing. Never mind. Let's not fight.
I just want to use this opportunity to point out that there's a severe and dismaying lack of dance fight, dance battle lists on Letterboxd, and we need a listener to fix this. And so if someone can fix that between now and the next episode, we will give you a shout. And the final question, I mean, it's a big question given how much you love the entire soundtrack, but for each of us, if you could pick one song from the West Side Story soundtrack that you could take with you to heaven, which would
come
it be?
Come on, man.
Slim, you go first.
Ah, gosh. I think I wrote it down here. Where is it? One Hand, One Heart. That song feels very Catholic. And I grew up like Catholic. That just hit me like, am I in church again right now as a kid? That's a great song, but One Hand, One Heart with the two of them singing together, unreal.
I didn't think it was a Catholic thing, Slim, but maybe it is, but it's One Hand, One Heart. And the reason is because my big sister figured out how to play it on the piano, and because it's a duet, would make me be Tony to her Maria and sing it over and over and over again. It's embedded in me.
I so relate to that as someone who grew up with a sister and would be like, you be the boy and I be the girl. And like, you know, oh, no, I wanted to be that part. You could be that part next time.
Exactly.
Grace, it's time. You can't wait any longer. You can't delay it.
No, here's the thing. Mine is kind of like a cheat answer because ideally I would pick every single song.
You're going to say Overture, aren't you? You're not allowed.
I'm not going to say Overture because that doesn't count. But I'm going to pick the prologue song, and that is because it is my favorite part of the movie. It is where we get, I mean, one thing about, like, I do love lyrics. Lyrics are great, but I am an orchestration girl over a lyric girl. And so, you know, in the prologue, we get these like crazy percussion sounds. There's like seven xylophones at once, and that's the sharks. And then we get like this like ba-doom, doom, 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 like bass line, and that's the jets. And so, and it's 6 minutes long. So that's, I would love, you know, the longer the song, the better. But I think it paints the picture the most, and it encompasses the characters to me the most. I will say it's not as like melodic, so you don't get much of the love story in the prologue. There aren't like the strings of Maria, which is a beautiful song. But if I had picked Maria, then I would be like, well, then where is the percussion? I mean, Maria is one of the greatest love songs of all time. But if I had to pick, and I know it's boring because I talked about it already, but it would be the prologue. Great. Just great.
Shocker of an answer. We're rapidly running out of time, but we do have, I think, at least one or two more segments that I think hopefully our community has come to expect on Letterboxd.com, rated higher than average. So we looked at your profile on Letterboxd to see what you've rated higher than the average on Letterboxd. So there are a few on here. The movie that I 100% agree with on this list is Annihilation, Natalie Portman. Underrated.
Don't even get me started on this movie. I probably in the last 5 years, the movie I saw the most in theaters, I think I saw it five times in theaters, never done that before, bought the book on the subway home from the movie the first time I saw it, read it in less than 24 hours, made friends with the composers. Not only that,
my God,
the Alien soundtrack at the end was, so when I was living in New York, I had just lost my job. I'll make this brief because we're going over time. But I was wandering Soho and I just kind of wandered into the Bose store and like for the sound quality. And I was like, just looking at, you know, headphones. And one of the guys was like, do you want to come into the Bose surround sound room? And I was like, sure, why not? And so I went in there and I'm sitting there and it kind of looks like a living room, but with this crazy sound setup, and they're playing The Greatest Showman, which I don't ever want to see. And so they were like, and so they're playing it for me and the sound was great. And I was like, this is amazing. And then I went home and I was like, I told my followers, I was like, I need to watch Annihilation in the Bose sound room. And I was like, everybody tweet at Bose that I need to watch Annihilation. Because when I first saw Annihilation, I have a video of this. I'm leaving the theater and my hands are shaking because I love experimental music. I love music that my favorite music is music that scares the fuck out of me. And so the third act of Annihilation is one of my favorite third acts. And a large part of it is because of the music. And so I'm like, everyone tweet for me to watch it at the Bose store. And so then enough people tweeted that they DM me and they were like, hey, just get the Blu-ray and you can come watch it. And then of course I moved to LA for 6 months and I still haven't been able to do it.
Oh my God.
But it's the score. I'm telling you, man, if that score was not there, it would have a way. I mean, it all comes back to music for me, but it was great. I do love weird alien shit. God, I'm getting so excited because I didn't think you were going to bring up Annihilation. And I love that movie.
So I think we need to shout out Jeff Barrow and Glenn and Ben Salisbury for their composition of Annihilation.
Incredible score.
We'll meet them in the Bose studio. We'll all hang out with them and watch the Blu-ray the next time you're in New York.
Yeah.
Coming full circle, really. Alan Partridge, Alpha Papa, you have rated 5 stars. The Letterboxd community, generally speaking, is like, 3.4 out of 5. But for you, it gets the full 5. And this
Here
we are again, Steve Coogan as Alan Partridge. There's something about the way that Steve and Armando have managed to keep Alan Partridge alive through all the, you know, progression of society we've experienced over the last 20 years. He knows he's irrelevant, right?
He's just not a good guy, and you know that. I mean, he sells his friend out in the first 15 minutes of the movie. But, God, to go full circle again, this time with dating stories, this was actually the most recent movie I watched. And I watched it with a guy I'm seeing, and he did not like it. And it hurt, and I'm usually like, okay, it's fine. We don't have to like all the movies. But he did not laugh, and I laughed so hard. But I don't know.
Wait, are you still seeing him?
Yes. I'm going to the wedding with him in a few days. So no, he's great. And you're not supposed to like every movie, you know, with the person that you are currently dating. But there are just some lines. Alan Partridge is a batshit radio announcer. And he'll be like, so next we're asking, have you ever met a genuinely clever bus driver? Like he's just... Like he's mean. He's mean.
He's racist against the Irish. Like racist against the Irish.
And he's like, you can make fun of Jews a little, you know? And it's like, I don't know. I could get canceled for liking it, but I will acknowledge that like he sucks. Like he sucks. And that feels like it's fine, right? I'm okay.
The main last question I have is, have you shown West Side Story to whomever you're dating yet?
Let me go to his Letterboxd and see if he's watched it.
Well, he gets points for being on Letterboxd.
This is
so
the big test. This could be the beginning or the end right now.
I think he has. But you know what? I think he has because I would remember being like, you haven't seen West Side Story? But he has. Yeah,
it's going to be 3 hours until you get laid.
If he has a 2-star on Letterboxd right now,
he has not rated it. He has not rated it. And I might just be afraid to ask. But he has not seen All That Jazz. And on our movie list that we share of films we want to show each other, All That Jazz is on there. But honestly, after showing him Alan Partridge, I'm like kind of nervous. So I don't know.
Well, what would you say to any man like my husband who says, I don't like musicals with absolutely no personal experience to back that up?
We did a whole episode of this on our podcast and I was literally like kneel. I was like sliding down in my chair because my host was just like, musicals are bad. And I was like digging my thighs so hard into my hand, I was bleeding. But I think what it says is that maybe it's too earnest for them. People singing, I think earnesty kind of turns off, especially in this like irony poisoned world. I think the earnestness of Hamilton turned away a lot of people. Which is fine, but I think it's the same thing where people don't like Hamilton because they don't like the fan base. And I think a lot of people say they don't like musicals. They want to say they don't like people who like musicals. I think that's a big part of it. And to be fair, we're really annoying. And a lot of us are really annoying. But, you know, if you can sit down and watch an art house film, you can sit down and like appreciate music and stuff, even if it's like in the movie Carousel, they're singing about clams and they say a Sam called June is busting out all over. Just a ridiculous name for a song. And they're literally jumping up and down because they love clams. It's actually not that great of a movie. But, you know, you know that no one would ever do this. So you appreciate the dancing. You appreciate the costumes, you know. I just think people who say that having not watched many, it strikes me as someone with a very lazy mind. No offense to your husband.
Too late.
I'm sorry.
Let's pit Hamilton fans versus A24 fans to the death and see who comes out.
Let's have them dance battle. And the musical theater kids would win. That's the thing. Their first win ever.
Thanks so much for listening to The Letterboxd Show. And thanks to our guest this episode, Grace Spellman, for sharing her love of her favorite movies. Her four faves again: West Side Story, All That Jazz, In the Loop, and Whiplash. You can hear Grace on The Ringer Music Show, and she's on Twitter too.
You can follow Gemma Slim, that's me, and our HQ page on Letterboxd using the links in our episode notes. Thanks to our crew, composing Dynamo's Moniker for their theme music, Vampiros Danzotech, and thanks to Jack for the facts, and our booker, Linda Moulton. And to you for listening. If you're enjoying the show and have guest ideas, be sure to leave us a review on Apple Podcasts.
And that's the show. I'm off to listen to some subsidized foreign vowels.
Little trouble there. Let's pick it up at 17. Ready? 5, 6, and... Not quite my tempo. Here we go. 5, 6, and...
This is a Tape Deck Podcast.